Yeah, you can hold on to that. I'm doing some other things. I don't know if they're related.
Welcome to the Mad River Anthology. I'm Tim Ayers. Known as the existential professor, Dick Stahl has taught classes in such unconventional areas as kinesiology and biomechanics, to sport and popular culture, to alternative medicine. He has performed spoken word with his band, what he calls jazz noir, and his topics range from classic literature to jazz and blues, and has explored one of his favorites, boxing, in his novella, Muhammad's Robe. Dick recently performed some of his work live in the KHSU studio with longtime collaborator, keyboardist Tim Randles. All right, Dick, so I've got it recording.
Okay, so I'll be speaking at about this volume. How's
that
sound? That's
perfect. Sounds great.
Is that good? Okay, you want to try that white space number, and if that works, it works. If it doesn't, we'll re-record.
Sounds good.
This is a little piece called White Space. When I was a young boy, my mother gave me a book by this architect called The Spaces in Between. I never understood that title. Got a job selling newspaper ads back in the 70s. Had to lay out ads. Boss told me the key, man. The key is white space. White space. Simple lines, a little copy. White space. Like Miles, when Miles changed Bop to cool. Cause 4 miles there was Bird, Charlie Parker the Bird. He was Bop. The Bird blew hard, frenetic, lots of notes. The notes between the notes. That's Bop. That's what Bird said. Then Miles got cool. Miles invented cool. Muted trumpet, a few notes. Quiet nights. Lots of space. White space. Like Sugar Ray, let you throw punches, lots of punches. Sugar Man, bobs and weaves, little head movement, drops those shoulders, don't need to move no feet. Sugar Ray's fighting Duran, hands of stone Duran, he's invincible, right? And Duran, he's missing, and he doesn't know why. He can't find the Sugar Man. And then Sugar Ray throws that snake's tongue left jab. Stings, pow! Duran's head snaps back, it's clean. Makes a statement. White space. Like Baryshnikov, hours of practice, 30,000 maybe, ballet, toughest of all, torture. He's dancing with the jazz master, Gregory Hines, dancing jazz, but you can't take your eyes off Baryshnikov. Tight black pants, white t-shirt, dancing jazz, but it's really ballet. Head and shoulders don't move, center line never tilts, no noise, clean, sexy, white space. There's this guy, Glass, composed a symphony. You sat there in the symphony hall, 4.5 minutes of silence. No noise, no coughs, no sneezes. Don't let anyone hear you breathe, brother. Silence. Gotta pay for the silence. White space. Wine. Red wine. Open the bottle, let the air caress. No, don't fill up that glass all the way. Now look at the colors in the light. Now slowly, slowly, raise it to your lips. Don't take your eyes off the glass. Lift the glass. Now smell the bouquet. Smell, put your lips around the glass. That's it. Now slowly tilt the glass. Your head too. Just a little now. Purse your lips. Let the wine roll into your mouth. Chew the body slowly, like love, just like love. Take your time, man. White space. Like a Vermeer painting, a woman staring, reflecting, silent, in repose. She's quiet, can't touch her. What's she thinking? White space. The real estate lady says the house is dank, musty, too many smells. Bake bread, she says. Bake bread. Make it smell like grandma's house, like the way it was when we had time. God, we need time. We all need time. Precious time. A little white space.
All right, can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Sure can.
Cool. Cool. Why don't you tell us about yourself just a little bit, Dick? How about a little bit of background?
Okay, pretty eclectic background. Born on the Berkeley Hills and the Bay Area in the early 50s, and had two very artistic, talented parents. So that was a huge influence. My dad was a singer and a philosophy professor and an ex-minister and corporate vice president and kind of all-around polymath. And my mother was actually a classical singer, professional classical singer. And all I wanted to do was box like Muhammad Ali and hit like Willie Mays. So I didn't really appreciate my Renaissance upbringing until much later. But it was wonderful, actually. And went to UC San Diego, was a communications political science major, went to three universities in Europe, came back, bartended in Washington, D.C., pulled green chain in a lumber mill here in Arcata, decided to go back, get another degree in physical education, studied martial arts and dance, wrote my doctoral dissertation on the physics of karate. I don't know. I could go on and on. But my greatest loves, actually, growing up, were sports, literature, and jazz. And that's been a constant. I listened to jazz since I was 7 years old. My mother read me Jack London and Road Stories when I was little, and I think imprinted me. So I always loved literature. I was always a huge sports fan. So a lot of my poetry and stories revolve around my academic life, but also my loves in music and in literature.
Tim, how about you? What path have you been on?
I came from San Diego, and my mother ran away with me when I was a little baby, took me off to Sacramento or somewhere. Huh. I got interested in music when I was eight. I started playing the trumpet, and it was a little difficult because it only had the three valves, so I couldn't get all the notes. So I switched to the piano after that. Oh, I switched to the clarinet for a while and then started piano. And been playing ever since. I've been obsessed with music. Just always knew since I was a kid that's what I wanted to do. Later on, I got my first jazz mentor. He was a really great pianist that played in New York for quite a while. He played across from Art Tatum, and so I learned a lot from him. Finally got out of Sacramento and came to Arcata. Got into the world music scene. I've been playing with Ponche, an Afro-Cuban band, and I was with an African band. We went to Senegal, got to do a show over in Senegal. That was pretty exciting. Been with Dick for quite a while, since the Danny Montgomery poetry series, years ago.
96, 97.
At Jambalaya.
Yeah.
And you had in the Band of Angels backing up Jerry Martin.
Yeah, and a lot of poets. I was with Dr. Gans for quite a while.
What's the effect you go for when you're working with spoken word material?
I guess just empathy. Try to feel what they're feeling and see if I can represent that in music somehow. Just go with that.
That's interesting to hear Tim say that because my mother, who was 85 at the time, who was a consummate musician, she came to a show we did at the Red Radish. And at the end of the show, she said, "Work with this guy." And she pointed to him. He's a musician's musician. And it was a high compliment because my mom didn't give out that many high compliments. So she really did recognize that how tuned in Tim was. I think every time I've seen him play, he's really listening to everyone else. And that's remarkable. This next piece is called The Graduate. I've been teaching here at Humboldt State for 20 years. A lot of my experiences here with my students I fictionalize. However, it's usually never fiction. It's usually always true. This is a little piece called The Graduate, and I'm dedicating that to all my Humboldt State students out there, those who have graduated and those who have not.
"Man, it's great to see you, Doc," he said. "Ben, good to see you. You graduating?" "Yeah, man. I got this great job with this environmental engineering company right here in town. I can't believe it. My dream come true." "That's great, Ben. That's just great. But you know," Ben continued, "what I really want to do is go surfing in Peru. I've been working so hard for so long, I'm only 22. I just want to take some time off, get in my VW van and drive through Mexico, Central America, down to Peru, check out Inca Land, go see Machu Picchu and drink Pisco Sours and surf some South American tsunamis." I smile and nod. "What do you think I should do, Doc?" he says. Ben looks at me with these intense blue eyes, flicking his surfer bangs to rest on one side of his head before they fall down over his eyes again. I don't need this kind of responsibility, I'm thinking to myself. Here I am just walking across the plaza to get a pumpkin ice cream cone. I mean, I remember how you used to talk in class, Doc. I mean, you would have done that, wouldn't you, Doc? Wouldn't you have done that? The Friday noon sun is shining through the fog. I notice the flag above the old historic storehouse, flapping in the wind, blowing from the north. I hear snippets of conversations of the street people on the grass. I turn around and recognize an older colleague of mine close to retirement coming out of Everett's bar. I want a pumpkin ice cream cone, but Ben awaits. My mind flashes ahead 15 years. Take one. There's Ben, short hair and a suit, wife, two kids, smiling, coming up to me. Doc, he says, great to see you. This is my wife, Liz, and my kids, Hannah and Scott. It worked out so great. I'm vice president of a consulting company now. We're building wastewater marsh projects all over the Northwest. Got our dream house up on the hill. Doc, I'm so grateful. Thanks so much for the advice. Liz smiles at me as Hannah and Scott run back and forth across the grass. He must be about ready to retire, Doc, he says. You know, I tell people, you're the best professor I ever had. Thanks for everything. I stand there and watch Ben and his young family walk off and get into their red Astro Beetle. My mind flashes ahead 15 years again. Director's cut. Take two. Hey, man. Doc. This guy's got a long, dirty beard. He looks to be at least 50, maybe 60. He's playing the congas. You changed my life, Doc. Excuse me, I say? It's me, Doc. It's Ben. Ben? Yeah, man. I went for it, man. It was you, man. You inspired me, man. You were right. All that stuff about Jack London and Kerouac and Whitman that you used to talk about instinct. I went for it, man. I went for it. And I never stopped. I stare at him for a minute. I start to ask a question, but Ben continues. Hey, man. Hey, I'm trying to get to Vancouver and hook up with some buds of mine. Can you spare a dollar? He looks at me with these hungry eyes. I reach into my wallet and give him a bill. He closes his fingers around my hands. You changed my life, Doc. Thanks. A couple of bikers pull up to the corner and the noise shakes me back to reality. Ben stands in front of me, muscled and tanned, intense, brimming with intelligence and life and possibility. What do you think I should do? He says. I take a deep breath. Come on, Doc. What would you have done? I pause. I would have gone surfing in Peru, I say. Damn, Doc, he says. Thanks, Doc. And he runs off, fist clenched high in the air. I take one step towards the storehouse. I stop, turn around, and I walk into Everett's. Except for one older guy at the end of the bar, I'm the only one there. Goddamn noise and riffraff on the plaza is worse than it ever was, bartender says. What do you have? Ever heard of a pisco sour, I ask. Never heard of it, he says. Forget it, I say. Just give me a beer and a shot of whiskey on the side. Okay, I'd like to dedicate this again to my students out there. That was Experience Out of Class, and this is loosely based on reality in the class when I used to teach a class called Biomechanics, which was the physics of sport in human performance, a class I love to teach, undergraduate class, and I tried to keep it interesting for all the math-phobic students out there by bringing in real-life dramatic sport experience. Well, here it is. It's called Basic Biomechanics, The Big Question. 11:40 a.m. It's like this, I said, looking out at their faces. We've gone over fundamental quantities. For our last 10 minutes, we're going to look how we represent the derived quantity, speed, graphically. The room was inert. You have time going from left to right on the x-axis. And you have distance going from bottom to top on the vertical axis. Think of it as an L, time on the bottom and distance going up. How many times have I done this, I think? I am in pedagogical purgatory, never to be reincarnated, never to fly with the chariots of the gods. But I refocus. Now I say, you're running away from the origin. What does the line look like on the graph? What does the line look like? I wait for the good soul, a know-it-all. I wait for anyone, anyone. It goes up at an angle, says Rachel disinterestedly. I glance at my watch. 11:42 a.m. Good, I say. Thank you, Rachel. Now, I gather my composure and go on. You're running back to the origin, I say. What does the line look like on the graph? What does the line look like? Nothing. Angela, I said, please help me. Pause. Okay, Doc, draw the line at an angle downward, she says. Right, I say. Thank you, God, I think to myself. The line angles down because as time elapses, you are getting closer to the origin. You're moving down the vertical distance axis, I explain. Angela, I think to myself, I will see that you pass if I have to mow the dean's backyard for the next 3 years. 11:45 a.m. Now I say, what if you have a line that starts halfway up the distance axis and extends out infinitely parallel to the horizontal axis? Partial puzzlement, a faint hope of interest, a barely audible irregular heartbeat emits from the naked masses in front of me. Come on, I say. I urge, entreat, implore. I'm getting too old for this, I think. You're standing still, Resnick says, slouched in his chair. Right, I say. There's no movement except the passage of time moving along the x-axis. 11:46 a.m. What, I say, pregnant pause for effect, if I draw a line from some point greater than zero on the x-time axis straight up parallel to the y-distance axis? They're puzzled, maybe mildly interested. No tables dropping to the sides or zipping up of backpacks. It's impossible, Doc, Resnick says. You can't be moving along the distance axis parallel to the time axis. It would mean movement without time. Another pregnant pause. Resnick, I love you, you smart bastard. I think to myself, I could kill you right here if I could. 11:47 a.m. And now, for the big finish, I catch my breath. Resnick's right, I say. Motion when time stands still is impossible in physics. But, I say, it happens. Oh, yes, it happens. This is the big one, folks. This is the zone. Don't you see? This is what you live for. This is a backhand stab behind third base and a frozen rope throw to nail the runner at first. This is when you fire a left hook body shot off your back foot and the bag stops dead. No vibration on the chain. This is the pump fake, get him in the air, fall away jumper from the baseline that grabs the net and jumps a millimeter for falling through. This is the big O. You spend your whole life trying to get there. And if you've been there, you never get back. Don't you understand what I'm saying? Don't you say when you're slain in the spirit of space and time? 11:49 a.m. Silence. I stop. The room is quiet as fallen snow on a chilly night. No one wanted to get up and put footprints in the snow. 11:50 a.m. Rustling, no talking. I strain to listen. Then I hear two students talking as they leave. He's crazy. The man's crazy, he said. Yeah, said the other. I wonder if that last piece is going to be on the test. All right, this little short piece is the conclusion of Doc Stull's academic poetry or stories. This is called Office Hours. It's the blue-collar students, the one with tattoos and ex-military, who always seem to adopt me as their father figure. I don't know why. I have this one student who's trying to get along better with his dad. They're even going to counseling together for the first time. Anyway, this kid comes up to me and starts talking about this new woman he's met. How she's got a boyfriend, but that she seems interested in him. So what do I do, he says. Hey, ever heard of Garcia Lorca, I ask. No, he says. Who's he? Spanish poet, I reply. Find some of his poetry. It's unbelievable. print it out, include it in a nice card, and get her some red roses. Find the right excuse to give it to her. She'll love it, I say. And if it scares her away, she isn't worth it. Really, yes. It's got to be done, I say. The kid says, what's the name of that guy again? Garcia Lorca, I say. Kid writes it down. I'm going downtown right now, Professor. You'd have done that, Professor, right? Absolutely, I reply. Damn, he says, eyes wide. He gets this big smile on his face, and he races off. State tax dollars spent on giving students a well-rounded college education. Don't you think?
Okay. So that's out of the office, in the classroom, and in the office. Fortunately, I'm tenured, so they can't fire me.
It depends. They got those guys coming in the room.
I guess so now.
Okay, the next piece here is called Barroom Theory of Everything. Hey, did you see that slam dunk? Took off from the free throw line, sucker hung in the air for 5 seconds. 5 seconds minimum, man. Floating on air. Incredible. Of course, it didn't happen that way. See, Newton's laws tell you, you can't be in the air more than a second. Impossible. Unless, guy's got a 40-inch vertical leap, and even then, it's only a second. That's just the way it is, man. That's just the way it is. Hey, women, let me tell you, man, can't bend out of shape about love, man. Love, kind of like bebop, what it does to your mind, man. You know how you start with this melody, you know, and the woman's the melody, and your mind takes off and does these spins and dives, and you got to go all around it. You just play a simple melody, see? That's the delusion, man. That's when you do, when you think about her. You make more about it than what it is. Look it up, man. Delusion. A false mental conception resistant to reason. Illusion. That's different, man. That's a perception that represents what is perceived in an unreal way. Different things, man. Leopard doesn't change his spots, man. Hey, Kipling. That's what he said. Leopard doesn't change his spots. Like women, man. Like love. You can claim ignorance by illusion. You're playing the sap with delusion. Little thing I made up, man. You like that, man? You like that? Michael Jordan floating on air. That's an illusion. Pretending it's really happening after you know the truth. That's delusion. Hey, bartender. Hey, can I get another beer here? Can I get another beer here? Hey, man, you like art, man? There's this guy Rothko. Guy draws these rectangles, blue one, red one, thin blue line. Hell, they say it's great art. I don't know. Looks like rectangles to me. Guy told me one time they had to do with geology. Primordial feelings. Said people wept when they saw these rectangles. Took them back to the beginning somehow. Hell, I don't know myself sometimes. Hey, bartender. Can I get another beer here? Can I get another beer? Hey, remember that cat who wrote Brave New World, Huxley? Smart guy. Started doing peyote back in the 50s when no one but the Indians were doing it. Huxley's in his studio doing this peyote, and like, he's got all these famous books and art pieces around him. And this guy starts to get interested in the folds in his pants. The weaves in his trousers were just as beautiful as the paintings on the wall. Hell, man, then everybody started dropping acid in the 60s, seeing the same stuff. And folks who didn't like it were telling them that they were just taking shortcuts to enlightenment. But it was their freedom they didn't like, really. See, remember that scene in Easy Rider? My man Jack Nicholson, he starts taking the bottle of bourbon and says, it's your freedom they don't like. Nick, you know, you have to earn your insights or something. See, you don't have to earn your insights. The sun sets for free, man. You don't have to earn it to appreciate it. It's for free. How do we get so screwed up? Hey, that's James Brown. Love that, make it funky. Yeah, see, the key, man, James Brown, he went after that first beat, attacked it, make it funky. Heard his bass player explain it one day. Yeah, man, after that explaining, you know, it's so darn obvious. Hey, man, what you in town for? Hey, nice town, what you in town for? Hey, let me tell you about religion, man, big con, metaphysics for the masses. German cat, Schopenhauer said that. Had it figured out. Hey, the Greeks had it figured out before him, had gods. Man, they were just like us, except they lived forever. Got bored up there and play us for sport. Hey, that's Lear, man. Do you like that King Lear? Hey, said it all, brother. Out, brief candle, life's but a stage, all that. That's Macbeth, the bard. Hey, bartender, can I get another beer here? Can I get another beer? I mean history, man. It's written by the winners, man. It's the final fiction, man. There's all this war and pestilence and disease, and all the crap of history just rolls down the big river of life, and it don't change, except there are these little people on the banks that go on living. They make fires, have families, they go on living. Hey, man, maybe that's history. Hey, can you get another beer here? Are you going, man? Are you going? Hey, it was nice talking to you. No, man, I'll take that beer, bartender. Yeah, add one for the road. One for the road, old Sinatra song, wasn't it? Yeah, did it after Ava Gardner left him for that matador in Spain. Nothing like old Blue Eyes. Man was a natural. Hey, it's all Darwin, Nietzsche, Freud. The rest is illusion. Maybe it's delusion. I don't even know the difference anymore. Hey, you closing, man? Yeah, okay, bartender. Yeah, what'd you say? Oh, you liked what I said about James Brown. And a history part, too. Hey, thanks, man. Night, bartender.
I'm exhausted.
I bet. You totally held it together, though.
I know,
all the way.
I held it together, man. I was on six beers, and I just powered through.
That was great. That was perfect. Great job.
Last piece I'm going to read is called The Shadowbox Blues. It's a show I did, actually, to honor the people that helped our family when our daughter died, Camila, of leukemia 2 years ago. And it was a show that I did to raise funds for St. Jude Hospital. And I centered it around my family's experience with boxing because I felt like that we had all had been through a very difficult match. And this was the opening piece, but in many ways, I think it could have been the closing piece, too. And I named the show Shadowbox Blues, and I hadn't written this until a day before the show. I had written everything else, and I really didn't know what I wanted to say or how I wanted to say it. And it was only 24 hours before I gave the show that I was able to come up with this. So this is the actual title piece of the Shadowbox Blues, and this is the poem of the same name. He's punching and missing, hitting nothing but air. Feet shuffling, now strutting in life's 20-foot square. Shadowboxing the phantom with the baleful stare. Jabbing and hooking, lungs are on fire. Shadowboxing the phantom, whose surname is Liar. Round after round, the shadow boxer answers the bell. The phantom gets stronger, a Bosch bloodhound from hell. Keep moving, they say, keep him off with your jab. Stay off the ropes, give us boxing display. But the phantom gets stronger, the shadow boxer is tired. Arms feeling heavy, feet moving and mired. 10 seconds comes the call and he rises from his stool. And he stares across the ring at the phantom, soul serene but cruel. The phantom's on fire, he's throwing from all angles. Shadow boxer's caught on the ropes, body, mind, and soul entangled. He takes a right to the head, and he looks into the crowd. Alligators playing saxophones and bats in blood shrouds. The world is whirling away, the shadow psyche is bled. While the phantom breathes olfactory fumes in his head. You're losing the fight, punch out, they all scream. The phantom's your mind, it's not what it seems. 'Cause we're all Shadowbox brothers and soul sisters too. Welcome to life, brother. It's the Shadowbox Blues.
So, Dick, what do you think it is that draws writers to the sport of boxing over the centuries? There's been so many and so much written about it.
Yeah, even Joyce Carol Oates, who I think has published over 50 books, and her dad was a Golden Gloves boxer, and she wrote probably the best analysis of boxing of anyone. Mm-hmm. And yet, you're right, Hemingway, Jack London, Norman Mailer, the list goes on and on. I think it's the primal element, and I think it's that once you're in there, no one can help you. It's all up to you. And the unpredictability of it, it's just everything. It's the footwork, it's the speed, it's the ability to take pain, it's fainting, it's getting them off the canvas, that metaphor for life. I think it's just probably the most primal, but at its best, I know people who don't appreciate the sport see this at first, but at its best, if you have two great fighters, it's really like a violenced ballet. The athletic lines and angles are absolutely beautiful, and so it's ballet with violence.
And 2 years ago, you had the benefit at Six Rivers Brewery, leukemia benefit in honor of your daughter.
That's right.
And I was there, and it was SRO, and so many people came out to support that. Spoken word with a jazz band, pretty remarkable. A lot of people, students, but also just probably folks you don't know who just came out to support, right?
Yeah, that was just a really great night. It just it meant a lot to me. Of course, my daughter had passed away 5 months earlier, and had this incredible fight against leukemia, and she was one of the ones who did not make it. She endured for 3.5 years and was a very valiant little character, a remarkable, creative, and noble little soul. And so many people identified with her and came out and to support her memory, also to support St. Jude Hospital, which was wonderful. The hospital was wonderful to us and to kids from all over the world. And so in many ways, it was a very hard show to do because of that very fact. And if you were at the show, it all tied together in the end. But it's a bittersweet memory, but a good memory.
It was a good cause, and I think people came out for you too.
Yeah,
you
know? Well, I think
combination maybe.
Yeah, I think we were very, very lucky. Our family was. If there was ever, I could never be cynical again, Tim, because of the support I got and our family got from friends and community in that effort.
And this is about the boxing tradition and in our family, going all the way back to my great granddad. Who was the greatest fighter you ever saw, Dad? Who's the greatest fighter you ever saw, Dad? My son asked. Well, there's a story out there that my great-granddad even boxed a couple of rounds with a gentleman, Jim Corbett, after Corbett retired. Corbett could dance, stick and move, punch going backwards. He even beat John L. Sullivan, the American hero. He said, I can lick any son of a bitch in the room. He beat him so bad, beat him like he was his daddy. He stole that line from Muhammad Ali, my son said. And I said, all the great ones steal from the great ones. But my grandfather's favorite was Jack Dempsey, the Manassas Mauler. Told me how Jack used to fight the bars for money when he was only 14. He used to imitate how Dempsey rolled his shoulders, throwing hooks and uppercuts, coming out of that low coal miner in the shaft crouch. So who did your dad think was the greatest fighter you ever saw? Well, my dad said it was Joe Louis. Loved the fighter, loved the man. He said Joe was perfection. 6'2" tall, 195 pounds, dynamite in both fists. He kept his weight forward, feet under every punch. My dad said it was thrilling to see Joe Louis put a guy away. So how long was he champion, my son asked. Joe Louis held the title for 12 years. No one ever held the title that long. Must have been 100 blues songs written about the Mississippi Delta to Chicago, all about Joe Louis. He was the first black athlete that everyone supported. My dad told me it would be impossible to explain what Joe Louis meant to the American public. Before he fought Max Schmeling in Nazi Germany in 1938, the only fighter to have beaten him, President Franklin Roosevelt himself, invited Joe Louis to the White House. He grabbed Joe's right arm and said, "Democracy needs these muscles, Joe." Son asked why, and I said, because the fight was bigger than just a fight. To the public, it represented good versus evil on an international proportion. Practically every American man, woman, black, white, Christian, Jew, they all stared at that Philco radio that night to listen to that fight, to listen to the rematch at Yankee Stadium, Joe Louis and Max Schmeling. And Joe Louis knocked Max Schmeling out in the first round. And my dad told me, maybe God existed after all. So you really saw him? Your dad really saw Joe Louis, my son said. Yeah, I saw him fight exhibition overseas when Joe took off for 4 years in the military to entertain the troops. So what happened to Joe Louis? It's a shame what happened. Greedy managers and the government he served took his money after he gave so much. My dad and I shook his hand at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, where the management gave him a job because he was so poor. And when he died in 1981, Max Schmeling himself paid for Joe's funeral. My dad said it was no argument. Joe Louis was the greatest fighter of all time. But didn't you see Muhammad Ali? Yes, I did, and George Foreman too. Each time it was electric. Ali could move like a dancer, throw punches from all angles, recite poetry, talk to the crowd. An Ali fight was more than a fight. It was an event. It was a happening. I've never seen anything like it. I saw him in his comeback fights after the government stripped him his title for 3.5 years when he was undefeated and only 28 years old and in his prime. I saw him come back, and then Joe Frazier beat him. And we went to the fight with Kenny Norton in San Diego. And Kenny Norton, the Marine from Pendleton that no one had heard of, broke Muhammad Ali's jaw in the second round. They wanted to stop the fight, and Ali wouldn't let him do it. And Norton beat Ali. So my buddies and I went up to L.A. for the rematch with Norton. Ali's last chance to contend for the title, people said, after he lost to Frazier and Norton. 12 rounds toe-to-toe, even fight with a minute to go. In the 12th round, it was pandemonium, and he just eked out a split decision. And then he beat Frazier in the rematch. So he became champion again? Not quite. Because George Foreman had come along and destroyed both Norton and Frazier, each in 2 rounds. Foreman was 40-0 with 37 knockouts. No fighter even went past 2 rounds with Foreman in 4 years. Everyone knew Ali could never be Foreman. So did you see Foreman? I saw him train. His trainers brought in the fastest light heavyweights and middleweights in the country. Told them to do everything they could to stay away from George. Coach George would cut off the ring, first in half, then in quarters. Then they'd yell 30 seconds, and George would get him in the quarter and annihilate him. It was the most brutal display of power we'd ever seen. They carried out 5 straight sparring partners. We all knew there was no way Ali could ever beat George Foreman. But he did. He beat him. Stood there against the ropes for 8 rounds and took a pounding, and then knocked him out in the rumble in the jungle in Zaire. Ali was something. I saw a living myth. So, what about Tyson or Holyfield or Lennox Lewis? Think they could have beaten Ali? I don't think so. But then my dad thought no one could have beaten Joe Lewis. My granddad said no one could have beaten Jack Dempsey. And my great-granddad said no one could have beaten Jim Corbett. So who was the greatest fighter of all time? There's a little hill in a little Northern California seaport that overlooks a beautiful promontory and a little harbor with fishing boats. There's a small restaurant there at the base of the pier that used to be a home for a family of otters, where the fishermen haul in their catch at the bay. And an old cemetery on top of the hill has headstones going back to the Civil War. And on this hillside, and under a majestic Doug fir, you can hear the cries of crows and tiny wrens. As the sea breezes blow off the Pacific through the branches, I ponder the benign indifference and beauty around me, and the new grass on a small grave. And I think to myself, we saw the greatest fighter of all time. You and me and your mom, we were there. She held the title for 12 years, just like the great Joe Lewis. It was your sister, Camilla Stoll, 1994-2007. I walk to my car and I drive home from my daughter's final resting place in hope day that one day we can all understand that even through the pain, how lucky we all were. We were there. We saw the greatest fighter of all time.
You've been listening to the finale of Dr. Dick Stoll's Shadowbox Blues, a benefit performance with his band featuring Tim Randles on keyboards, Jeff Doherty on bass, and Mike LeBolle on drums, recorded live at the Six Rivers Brewery in McKinleyville in November 2007. The interview and studio performance with Dick Stoll and keyboardist Tim Randles before that was recorded 2 years later, nearly to the day, in the KHSU studios. For more information about Dr. Dick Stoll and his projects, and to contribute to the Community for Camilla Fund, visit existentialprofessor.com. And you can see Doc Stoll read live at the annual Multicultural Poetry Reading, along with Marlon Sherman, Barbara Curiel, Ian McDonald, Shauna McCovey, and Daryl Chin at the HSU Library's Fishbowl Room on Friday, April 30th from 2 to 3 p.m. You've been listening to the Mad River Anthology. I'm Tim Ayers. If you have questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. On our blog, an online archive of past programs can be found at madriveranthology.wordpress.com. The show is also available in iTunes. The Mad River Anthology airs the second and fourth Sundays of the month at 10 p.m. and is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University in Arcata, California.